No, it's more like OCD. It's like when you say three, I have to like whisper it to myself. Like I have to be like three. I'm counting with you.
Guys, you're nodding. Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. That's a bit of a mouthful for an intro, but I've been doing it for, I don't know, however many years now. You're Richard Wally, my co-host from Portland, Oregon.
And you're Cassidy Robinson from the LA area. LA Nighters?
Angelinos.
I don't like that. I'm not going to say that.
Today we're going to be reviewing The Witch, and at the end of the episode we're going to be reviewing Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures. But before that, I wanted to ask you, do you have a seasonal response to the music you listen to? Like, do you have winter music and summer music? Because I definitely for sure do. And it's not even something I mean to do. Mm-hmm. It's just like... It's like, you know how, like, whenever...
It picks up really heavy in October. For me, right. It does anyways. Like, in those fall months, all of a sudden, it becomes really heavy.
Like, the amount of music you're listening to, or the music itself is...
Music I listen to itself becomes much heavier.
You just get really aggro in October?
Apparently. All of a sudden, if, you know, like, Black Flag comes out or something like that, which you shouldn't listen to in traffic. It's just not a good idea. It's just bad planning. But yeah, and just heavier bands, maybe some strung out, their later stuff, not their early stuff. Their early stuff is more skate punk oriented, but you know, loud guitars, really fast, that kind of stuff.
So that you definitely notice that happening, whether consciously or unconsciously.
Oh yeah, it's definitely unconscious.
but it's always around the same time.
But yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. I always know that it's coming.
Okay. Because I noticed, like, I don't know, maybe it has to do with seasonal depression, which it's non-diagnosed. It's just whatever.
Oh, I have. Well, if we want to talk about that, we can get into my clinically diagnosed.
Well, but yeah, I think we've both talked about that, especially when we lived in Idaho. It's not as oppressive in California, where the weather never changes, which brings about its own kind of malaise. But yeah, for whatever reason, January through March is just, I'm a little bit more blue.
See, I am clinically diagnosed with the seasonal affect disorder, the SAD, the SADS. But when I was in Argentina, so the seasons are reversed. Mm-hmm. And so during the what would be winter, I was always fine. But then when it hit the rainy season, the rainier seasons, like in June, July, August, it was just reversed. So it was a very strange feeling.
So it is connected to the weather.
It's connected to the light. How much light you're actually getting from the sun. I mean, it's not just like the season, is it? It's literally how much UV rays your eyes are taking in and how much chemicals your body's producing.
Maybe I should go outside more.
Well, that's a problem too for some folk.
I find myself in the winter months, like around now, mm-hmm. I delve heavily into Jesus and Mary Chain and The Cure, mm-hmm. and The Smiths. Mopey British post-punk, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The whiny stuff, right?
Whiny stuff. Like 90s post-hardcore, like emo stuff.
Like Sunny Day Real Estate? Like that kind of thing?
Yes, although... Okay. Have I done that recently? No, but I actually just discovered a band that's kind of like new, which never happens to me because I'm old now.
Right.
I maybe discovered like a band a year now, but I started listening to this like kind of newer band who's called Modern Baseball.
Hmm.
And they're influenced by all of that kind of like post Sunny Day Real Estate stuff. It's been hitting the spot. Hmm. Maybe it's because I'm unemployed. Maybe it's because it's a winter months.
No, when I'm really sleep deprived, for some reason, the thing that really hits the spot for me is Modest Mouse, the Antarctica one. I can't remember the full name.
The Moon in Antarctica.
Yeah, The Moon in Antarctica. That's the first thing that goes on when I'm very sleep deprived. I don't know why. It's just like there's a thing in my head that clicks and goes, it's time to listen to it.
It's kind of trippy. I get it.
Maybe that's why.
A lot of atmospherics.
Well, it's kind of sleepy album. But angry. So, I mean, maybe that's just the reason.
You're mad that you can't go to sleep?
Maybe.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and get into the movie news. We do have some of that.
And we are a movie review podcast.
And we are a movie review podcast, despite this opening rant.
About health issues or mental health issues in music.
And the music that we happen to be listening to. What was your first one? I think I assigned to you the Mary Poppins news because I know that you specifically are obsessed with both Emily Blunt and Mary Poppins.
Yeah, I love Mary Poppins. I always have. Like that's one of those ones that I have always said, like, just not even no irony to it. I fucking love Mary Poppins. It's happy. They go dance in a cartoon. She makes them take their medicine with sugar. It's good news. It's good news all around. Emily Blunt, on the other hand, she's a fantastic actress who happens to be really kick-ass in a lot of things. You know, whenever I see her, I don't necessarily like the movie, but when I see her, I'm like, yeah, I believe that. But here's where these two things I love come together, and maybe not in a good way. Because Emily Blunt, while she's rumored for this role to take place in Depression-era, kind of Mary Poppins kind of sequel story, maybe... I like Emily Blunt when she plays a hard ass. You know, like Looper, the Robot Pants movie with Tom Cruise.
Yeah. And Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow, yes, Robot Pants.
/ Live, Die, Repeat.
Yes. Or most recently, Sicario.
Yeah.
So those films, absolutely love her. And that's what I want to see her do. Now, I'm not saying she can't, but there's, I don't know. This to me doesn't say necessarily like, yes, Mary Poppins.
Mm.
Like, I see her beating the children. So those two things, I don't know. It depends on how they're going to do it.
If she's kickboxing the children or like teaching them how to fight in Knife robot fight pants.
In 1930s.
In the 1930s, pants. Maybe steampunk robot pants.
Yes.
Then you're all for it. But if she's just going to be flying around on an umbrella, then... With talking to cartoon birds.
I'm sure she can do it. I mean, she is a good actress, but I just, you know, when somebody just like they personify something for you.
She's a lot. Yeah, I get what you're saying.
She has an icy, like it's not a complete ice queen, but she has like an, that's funny because they're going to have that movie coming out. Huntsman.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's in that movie, but.
She is an actual ice queen in that, but that's not what I mean.
Well, I wouldn't even necessarily say that she's icy, but she's not soft. Like, she's not like Julie Andrews, who has this kind of like rosy-cheeked, warm, grandmotherly feel, even when she was like in her 20s.
Yeah.
Like, she is a little bit, she's kind of like a bit more of a spitfire. She's a bit more of kind of a tomboy.
Well, I just feel like she has a harder edge. And like, I do think that there, I do think she has a little, it's not full Ice Queen. It's not like somebody like the chick from Mad Men. I believe that, you know, she's a little harder and she wouldn't have a problem punching you in the face. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I want her to punch me in the face. So I just believe her in that type of performance. So I don't know. I don't know what we're going to be looking at here. And I can't really name a lot of performances where she is. I guess people would point to like a Devil in Prada or.
Well, she was in like, what was that movie where she was with Jason Segel, The 5-Year Engagement? Like,
I didn't see that one.
She can do like the girlfriend kind of thing. She can be kind of bubbly or whatever, but she's not in the same kind of Julie Andrews grandmotherly matriarchal sort of way. It's she's more
we have a different girlfriend. Interpretation of Mary Poppins. I know. Your grandmother thing. I'm super attracted to her in that.
I mean,
like, even as a kid, I was like, man, I want to marry Mary Poppins one day.
My other question would be, was what is this movie? Because they're saying it's a sequel or a semi-sequel to the Disney Mary Poppins, which was already like a pretty loose adaptation of the book that it was based on, which the writer was very against ever being made into a movie, despite what that Saving Mr. Banks movie said. Mm-hmm. And so is it going to be a sequel to the Disney version, or is it going more from the literary source, or like, what the hell is this?
Well, I mean, they can pull from it. It is like there were several books written and she just came into random households and straightened shit out. So, I mean, she could,
yeah,
maybe it's going to be a political satire where she comes in and she straightens out the president's kids and makes FDR the man he, you know, cure the depression, something like that. No,
I mean, I'd watch that, I guess.
Well, you know, the first one, he's a banker. They get him to go outside and fly a kite.
All right. My first story here is, or my only story, is we've been talking a lot about this It remake for the Stephen King's It.
It comes up like at least once a month, it feels like.
It's like every 3 months. But yeah, originally, Cary Fukunaga, who did Beasts of No Nations this year and also the first season of True Detective, he was originally attached to direct it, and he got into conflict with the studio and ended up leaving because they didn't want to make the movie he wanted to make or concede to the changes he wanted to make to Stephen King's source material. So now the movie is going to be directed by Andrew Muschietti, who did Mama, a horror movie that we reviewed 2 or so years ago, and written by the writer of Annabelle, which I don't think either of us saw.
Nope.
Thought
it was a cash grab.
Yeah, it was, and it wasn't very kindly reviewed, but we were big fans of The Conjuring. But the big news story here is that apparently the studio has agreed, Warner Brothers has agreed to split this movie into two parts. So much like, I would assume, the TV special from the early 90s, which was done on like a 3-day release or whatever, like it was maybe it was 2 days, 2 nights they showed, like, and they basically split the story up into when the main characters were kids, and it's like Stand By Me with an Evil Clown.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're adults and they have to go back and, you know, defeat the evil in their past again. So actually, I'm into this idea. I mean, as much as I like economic storytelling and as much as I like, you know, trimming the fat, mm-hmm. This is such, like, it is such a tome. And it's such a kind of epic story. It's like the coming of age story to end all coming of age stories.
Well, there is a reason to split up a book when they're really large. And that book is very large. And besides that, it makes sense just like as a story, like,
yeah,
you got the
structurally,
kids.
Structurally,
I mean, yeah. You can blend that and there are ways to make that work, but. And I could actually see kind of a cool, maybe they do like a super cut of it, like afterwards, where they blend in together and you see the different like problems of the people.
You could go back and forth in the timeline. Like I could see how you could make it either way. Mm-hmm. But I actually thought like if this is to be done and maybe it's not on the table anymore, but I think it should be done as like a full season miniseries, like, you know, 12 episodes. Cause there was just so much in there. And like every character is given like a full, like 100-page chapter about who they were, where they come from, what bullshit they're going through in high school or middle school. And then they're like, and then there's like another 100-page chapter of what their lives are like as adults.
Right.
Like, I mean, it's just a massive, massive amount of information about these characters. And you don't have to use all of that, but I think that, you know, over
you can
pick
and choose what character speaks, what point of view is the most important.
Yeah.
Whether you wanted to make it more of a narrative or more about, you know, a character study there are different ways to make it work. But I mean, that being said, watching it, you know, in two different parts by age, I think that could be interesting and well done. I mean, I hope it's used as an actual storytelling device and not just a convenient way to split it up.
Like, right. I agree with that. I mean, what I really hope is that this isn't just, going to be a rehash of the 90s television series or the television miniseries, because we had that, and it's, you know, it's beloved by a certain kind of horror fan for the when it came out, and certainly we've talked about this. Tim Curry steals the show, and it's a iconic performance, but the movie does not really stand up, and most of the child performances are bad to terrible.
Right.
And the special effects are pretty laughable by today's standards. All, one, because it was a TV movie, and two, because it just because of the time it was made in 1989, 1990. So I hope that they're not just like going to take the story, the exact same story beats of that, and then just like modernize them or make them.
I like the idea. Yeah, I like the idea of Cary Fukunaga, but Annie Muschietti makes just as much sense to me. I'm one of those weird horror guys that was actually into Mama, and
I liked it for what it was. I wasn't over the moon about it, but I liked it.
Yeah. Well, that's more or less my opinion. it didn't blow me away, but yeah. But I do think that it had very atmospheric and like fairy tale like scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's very necessary for an It movie. And I also think, you know what? Those kids, he pulled some pretty cool performances out of both of them. So
yeah, he can do creepy, and he can direct children well. So that's really the key stakes in retelling the story.
Yeah. My last story, I have on the wrong page. Let's go to the right page. There we go. So Pacific Rim 2. Pacific Rim was a movie done by Guillermo del Toro. Everybody knows that. Big robots, big monsters, they fight each other. Well, they were always going to do they had been talking about doing a sequel, and it's been on again, off again, especially with the whole Legendary versus Universal thing kind of coming back and forth. Well, del Toro decided that he wanted to make it, and he wants it to still happen, but he doesn't want to wait around to do, you know, several years for a movie to happen again. That might not happen. So Deadline is reporting that Legendary Pictures has chosen showrunner Steven S. DeKnight. You might know him from Daredevil or maybe one of the Spartacus things. Is going to take over for feature film. I think this might be his first feature. I'm not exactly sure on that, so you can tell me I'm a big old liar. I don't care.
Okay.
But... he'll be coming back to do the sequel. I'm pretty sure that Guillermo del Toro will still be producer because he was a huge creator on the first one, but he's moving on to other things. It looks like a series called Troll Hunters with James Cameron, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, and also the remake of Fantastic Voyage. So, I mean, he's got a few things on his plate still.
As he always does.
Yeah. But the other part, Steven S. DeKnight, if we're talking about his other films, or at least I guess TV as like a showrunner, they have sort of a harder edge to them, and Daredevil, at least, I haven't seen Spartacus, so I can't comment on that, but Daredevil definitely had a kind of gritty noir or neo-noir kind of more look to it. So I could see some of that coming into it. I don't know. This is one of those ones that has a lot of cachets, but I think could possibly, it could go either way with Steven S. DeKnight in the helm.
I think what we're seeing is we're seeing a lot of TV people drift over into film, mm-hmm. into these big projects too, not just like making their little indie or making it, you know, a little genre piece or something like that. Like they're being, you know, taken from these 3-day productions where they're on set, you know, either running a show or directing episodes to making Captain America Winter Soldier.
Right. And that with that example specifically, that wasn't a bad one.
No, that was a success. And maybe set a precedent for what we're seeing now with all of these people going, well, fuck, why pay so-and-so Joe Hollywood X amount of money if we can draft in TV people? I didn't know that was an option.
Well,
I think we're seeing that more and more. And I looked on his IMDb credits. He has directed 3 episodes of Angel, 2 episodes of Smallville, 1 episode of Dollhouse, and 1 episode of Daredevil. Mm-hmm. So he was a Whedon guy.
He's a Whedon guy.
As was Drew Goddard.
Yeah, but he was also more of the showrunner on Spartacus, which... which is kind of like a TV series' director more. They're the ones that call the shots. They're the ones that everything's filtered through. Directors on the actual individual episodes are kind of the, like, to quote the television creator from Carnival, the directors in the TV world are the writer's bitches. Like,
a little bit more. Yeah. It's always TV's always been known more as a writer's medium or a producer's medium rather than director. Directors, really, their job is, you know, here's all the pieces, now just put it together.
Well, and the reason why there's a showrunner is because there's continuity, and to bring that continuity to each episode, you have to have somebody to facilitate that. And I mean, a director is just middle management. It's coordinating all of the parts to a bigger sum. But I mean, it goes both ways, because TV and movies are becoming more incestuous as is. I've just watched the second episode of Vinyl from Martin Scorsese, and he directed the first one, and it was 2 hours and 15 minutes of a pilot. That's more than feature length almost.
Yeah. I mean, even though that would be like a short film for Scorsese, but right. Well, yeah, I'm not saying that because he comes from the world of TV that he's not going to be appropriate for the job, or that he can't do it, or that it's even in or out of his wheelhouse. That I don't know. What I do know is that the stuff that I like about Pacific Rim is very Del Toro specific. Like, sure. You give that same movie to fucking Jonathan Liebesman or Michael Bay or whoever, and they very well could do a movie like that, but would have been intolerable.
Well, that's through a very specific production company, too. I mean, this is where, like I said, there's a lot of, there's a lot of little areas here that you can say it could fail here, but it could, and that definitely is one of them. There is some very specific Del Toro, the Hannibal Chow. My favorite stuff was Hannibal Chow and Charlie Day's character.
Yeah, the quirky character dynamics, that was, you know, and the production design, obviously, and just kind of the exuberance and sort of youthful joy of the movie.
It was a live-action anime. Like, even some of the characters, like, at first I was like, this is really weird. And then I was like, when I would see, like characters in like an anime, and then I'd be thinking about like the head mechanic or whatever that is. But anyways, he's an anime character. It's not even a real, like, this isn't like a realistic depiction. So if you're talking about something specifically that Del Toro can do, that I don't think other, because I think people can do the quirky characters, and maybe even Steven S. Knight might be able to. The other things is that quiet moment right in the middle, where you go, where you're going into a flashback of Maeko's, where she's being as a child, and she's in that alley, and there's all this just heavy atmospherics and like feeling, and it's like, oh, it's just a very elemental scene. That's the stuff that Del Toro can do that I don't know if Steven S. DeKnight can do. But at the same time, Steven S. DeKnight has a much harder edge, and that could be something that would be very interesting to me about a Pacific Rim. If it gets a little bit, I don't think it has to get darker necessarily, but more gritty could be interesting.
That's true as well. Okay, well, that's the movie news. Let's go ahead and get into our review. And this is Robert Eggers' The Witch. It was released by A24, which is a indie company that's made pretty big splash in the last couple of years. Especially towards end of the year stuff, and now we're seeing kind of genre material. A24 is almost like at the same level as like Annapurna, as far as drawing interest and buzz around their projects. And this was bought out of Sundance last year, where it was critically praised and kind of buzzed around the Sundance Film Festival during that whole thing. I think it won the Audience Award last year's Sundance in 2014. Right.
More in the It Follows Ex Machina camp.
Yes. And I would say that this movie in general, I think sort of tonally fits in that realm, if we're talking about sort of this slower paced, more philosophy driven intellectual horror filmmaking or genre filmmaking. The basic plot is we have a family in around like the late 1600s, Puritan family who are exiled from New, they're like, I guess, slightly bigger town. When we're talking slightly bigger, maybe a couple hundred people. They're pilgrim town in New England out into the woods where they're going to try and make it on their own. We have two twins, a husband and a wife, a baby and a daughter, and a slightly older son.
By slightly older, you mean like 10.
Right. He's like 10, 11 years old, and their oldest daughter is somewhere in her mid-teens. And if you know anything about Puritans, they're constantly praying away sin. They're obsessed with sin. They're obsessed with the very idea that they could be sinning and not even realize it. And if there, if one of the many tones that I think is, oppressive in this movie is that of guilt. And I think that's a major theme that runs all throughout this movie is, religious guilt. And basically, through a series of unfortunate events, their oldest daughter ends up becoming accused of being a witch. And there is, some creepy stuff that's going on within the family, within these dark woods that they live around. And it's a little, there's a little hint of a mystery in here as far as, is it real? Is it not real? If one of them is a witch, which one is it? And that kind of stuff.
Well, specifically, too, it's something that happens within the story is that the whole family, you did kind of explain this, but it needs to be really kind of, they're isolated. And it, see, one thing that I wasn't sure that was going to, I wasn't sure about going into the movie is I didn't know that, that the whole, it was the isolation of the family and being accused within the family. It's not by the city. This isn't the Salem witch trials.
This predates the witch trials, I think, by like 100 years. Or even more.
Yeah. But what I mean is it's not the town and it's not that, that sort of, it's the family it's accusing each other and the paranoia just within, you know, 5-6 people. That I didn't know going into the film. I don't know if it's, right. I don't know. It does make a difference though, because it does make it quieter and a different type of movie in a lot of ways.
An isolative kind of paranoia, like almost similar to John Carpenter's The Thing in a way, where everyone's kind of, you know, looking at each other at suspicion, as well as The Shining, Kubrick's The Shining, tonally and structurally, the movie's somewhat similar too.
Well, I mean, this film is very much based in being ambiguous, like without... and that's not a bad thing. That's a really good thing for the film. Basically it makes you question every assumption about it. Now for me, the true horror in all of this, as a horror film is the fact that it's not the modern era and how horrible it would have been to, be in a time period where you don't know if it's a natural cause out there. It's a supernatural cause. It's just you being crazy. Like, because at that time and from a human perspective, you wouldn't know. What got under your skin it's weird because it kind of shifts in between like a realistic drama, a super, like a thriller, and a supernatural kind of horror. And it shifts in between them. And so you don't know what movie you're actually watching. And really any of those interpretations, like anybody could like say like, oh, well, it was really this or it's really that. I think you could support it within the film and it wouldn't be wrong. I don't think it's even really important what is right and what's wrong.
What I think is one of the key things going into the movie, and it's right at the opening credits, is it says The Witch, a New England folktale.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we took that class on monsters where we studied old folk legend of both American and Slavic nature that, like, you know, and the way that stories were kind of archetypal, and there's these specific tropes that they all kind of followed, but they were also, it was fuzzy as to, are these historical accounts or are these like things that spun out of control over word of mouth, or maybe there's no difference between the two.
Well,
and that's definitely the approach this movie comes to with the mythology.
When you said that, something that came to mind actually about that class is when we would look up local legends. like that we'd heard as kids and you'd go out to the haunted sites or whatever, is that we would look them up and they all had these like basis in old world, like mythologies and legends that had come from, you know, from this time period. And it was insane that they were still around. So, I mean, to some degree, it's kind of funny to, it's kind of funny to point at this film and be like, oh, it's, you know, it's just then, you know, I think the most interesting part about it is perspective in this film. And those different perspectives that we're talking about, what kind of film it is, because, we as humans are limited. We only have so much that we can look at or can see. And within this, it even goes back further and strips away a lot of like our empirical sciences and stuff like that. And so I guess it frightened me in the fact that I guess it didn't frighten me. It just made me feel really happy that I was born in the modern era and not in the 1600s.
Thank God I'm not a pilgrim.
Yes. Yes. That was my first thought watching this film. Like, it's not a deep one, but that was really my biggest consensus watching it. I should probably watch this film again because that was the thing that ran through my mind the whole time. I was like, man, I'm glad I was born now. Man, I'm glad I was born now. Some of the perspective even from time, you know, from the time period is interesting because you're talking about how you're like, they get banished from the town, the small town of like 100, 200. But at the time, that was a huge city.
Well, and that was like one of the first American settlements, like, period. I mean, you know, the actors who are starring in this movie, they're all speaking with this kind of old English accent. So they're still saying things like hither and thee and thou and that type of stuff. And, you know, to the credit of the actors, they're able to speak in this manner in a very naturalistic way. It doesn't sound like Shakespeare in the Park.
Yeah.
Which you would, knowing that going in, you might be worried that it might, but they really naturalize this dialogue and they bring so much, pathos and emotion to every character.
Well, most of them are English actors, so
yes,
it's probably a little easier for them.
Right, and they maintain a certain accent, like, you know, and it's probably skewed a little bit so that it sounds a little bit more like early American than less like pure, you know, British, but modern British. But
I read little factoids on this specific movie because I was just curious. They used a Yorkshire accent.
Yes.
Because they didn't want it, because even if they used like a specific, like to the time and to the right place and the right kind of, like, it would sound really silly and people would really be focusing on that they were saying knife instead of, you know, just knife. And so they picked a very specific English accent to make it seem authentic, but also to make it seem so. I mean, he went through a lot of, this is a very researched film in a lot of ways.
A lot of primary research, yeah. Mm,
so
I mean, it's both based on actual legend and actual cases from this time period, like diaries and that type of stuff, whatever he was able to dig up from, you know, public libraries and that kind of thing, and also kind of mixed in with an original story of his own. And so one of the key elements that I think makes this movie work as much as it does is that it there is an intense focus on period detail. Both in the accents and in the language, as well as the costuming, the design, the production design. You know, it never feels like a BBC production.
No. It really
immerses you in this world.
It feels very real. I will say, again, maybe too real for me, because I was like, man, I'm glad I wasn't born then. going back to the perspective thing, what I'm speaking about specifically with that too is like what I just came to mind was these kind of magical thinking that, I mean, all humans use, all of us use. I mean, sorry to throw you under the bus, but the first thing that came to mind when I thought about this magical thinking was like you with the movie Nightmare. You've never had sleep paralysis. You've never woke up in during sleep and had that, but you are deathly afraid of it.
Yes.
And so, and you can't even watch that film, even though it's just a film.
It's a documentary.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so if you apply that to kind of this movie and its themes and stuff like that, it's interesting for us now because it kind of takes us back to that base human creature that we are, that animal trying to explain what's around us, the wolves in the woods, the society around us, the religion around us, all those sorts of things.
Well, one of the main, there's a lot of, I think we've been kind of dancing around the bus here, mm-hmm. if that's an expression at all. I don't think it is.
I don't think it is either, but go for it. Dancing around the bus. I'll use that from now on.
Dancing around the bus. I love this movie. I mean, and the more I've, I'm about a day or so away from it. I cannot get it out of my head. And I wasn't necessarily, I was kind of worried that it would freak me out,
mm-hmm.
like for a lot of various reasons.
What did anything freak you out in it?
It's creepy. And there's a slow building intensity to it in a very Kubrickian sort of way. And it's definitely, there's specific images and specific things. But more than anything, I left the theater with just a gigantic grin on my face because as far as I can tell after one viewing, this is a damn near perfect movie. Hmm. Like I think this is about as good as this kind of genre filmmaking can get. And both on a story level, on a subtextual level, I think there's a lot of stuff. Some people have said this movie style over substance, and those people couldn't be more wrong. I think this movie is working very much philosophically, and very much dealing with a lot of different kind of themes about what, which we've already kind of gone into as far as the difference between suspicion and superstition and religion and mythology, and how at a certain point of time and in these characters' heads, it's all the same thing.
Well, when you go into and if you want to kind of make it more contextualized, because it is hard to kind of put yourself in their position, because again, we live in the modern era. And modern interpretation is so they're in the survival mode and everybody's looking for a reason, and they all have different perspectives on, I mean, even if we're talking religious, like even some of them kind of are like, maybe not, are more empirical in what they believe. And some of them are less, some of them, you know, like the mother is very religious. We'll just put it that way. And then, but the father, on the other hand, even though he slips into that, he's actually very empirical. And he goes out and he's like, we got to hunt. We got to do something realistic, as well as the daughter. And so these different characters, they could be kind of types for different people now, but one interpretation I would say would be that, in the survival mode, when things get bad, we all start looking at the other person to kind of point fingers and say, who's the devil?
Right.
And so
and there's a fairy tale nature of the storytelling in that way. Right. It's very archetypal in that way.
Yeah. And I really appreciated that. I really appreciate the styles, the kids in it, the two youngest,
the twins.
Yeah. They really bothered me.
Like in a bad way or in a good way or both?
Well, I mean, really both, but they kind of like, they bothered me as
they're
like,
scared. They're creepy kids. I mean, as far as like
they work. Yeah.
As creepy kids in movies. This movie's so drenched in atmosphere.
Well, I mean, even one interpretation, is that if you do go with the complete supernatural ones, I think that they are the, they're the dynamic force. Yes.
Well, and let's get into that a little bit. Because one of the few things I knew going into this movie, because I try not to read too much about movies before going in, especially stuff like this,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, very dependent on its reveals, this was endorsed by the Church of Satan.
Right.
And they've been doing these little private screenings, all around the country. And even A24 has kind of embraced this endorsement, and they've released like alternate
on their online website trailers. And stuff.
Yeah, saying like, you know, here it is.
Well, it didn't do. I mean, even though like parents threw fits and stuff like that, like in the 1970s, like when that kind of stuff happened, like people are like, Exorcist. People are like, oh, it's evil. I still want to go see it because that it gets me to be able to get that much closer to kind of touching like supernatural or something.
Right. And I'm sure that was their intent when they did that. It was very much a William Castle kind of like gimmicky kind of way to get people into the theaters. It's like, oh, this is the movie that the Satanists like. I'm sure they were happy as pie when they got that endorsement for their horror film. And it hasn't quite taken off in that kind of way, which is kind of a little disappointing. I would have liked to seen some like angry Fox News video about don't take your kids to this satanic movie.
I don't think talking about period and it's being a little important. I don't think that it's not the same as the 1970s now.
Well, and it's still early for the release. We'll see if it picks up steam.
Okay.
But with that said, I will say I definitely see why that particular group gravitated toward this movie. And I think that one of the ways you could read this movie, and I think one of the key messages of the movie is that you know, the struggle between sin,
mm-hmm.
And what we perceive as sin as natural human inclinations, and faith is a losing battle. And there is key imagery in this movie and key characters that play very much into this good and evil battle that plays out. And, you know, this movie is kind of black metal as fuck.
Well, it could be interpreted. It could be interpreted a number of ways. And another way that could be interpreted is the oppressive nature of the church on women.
The feminist subtext is there if you're looking for it. I actually don't think that's the key. Like, I don't think this is a Scarlet Letter type story.
No. Again, that's why I led with my personal interpretation, which I find the most interesting about the film, which is about perspective and magical thinking.
That's definitely in there.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to alarm people if you are of religious nature or whatever. I don't think seeing this movie is going to put you in league with the devil or anything like that. What I'm saying is that the argument that the movie is making, one of the arguments that the movie is making, is kind of pro-pagan and kind of, I wouldn't say anti-Satan per se.
I wouldn't say it's pro though either.
And what I mean by that is not like in a exorcist, you know, pull out the crucifix kind of way. I mean more in like the Levian philosophical sense of human nature as the natural inclination and religious ideology being the unnatural.
Sure.
But given that, I think that is for a horror film, a pretty bold philosophical point of view, and one we don't see that often, especially with period films. And two, more than the spirit of Satan over this movie, the spirit I felt over this movie, and I've name dropped a lot of directors, more than any of it, I feel the spirit of Ingmar Bergman all over this movie.
I think that's a good, especially if you're talking some of his
And The Virgin Spring,
right,
and The Seventh Seal, The Magician, all these movies, because one of the things I know about Ingmar Bergman is that he came from a very religious background that he later turned away from. So a lot of his movies deal with faith and battling faith and sort of the ideas of human superstition. Looking into the director a little bit out of the movie, I've seen all those names name dropped by the director himself, which just made me feel very, very smart. because the whole time, because halfway through this movie, I was like, yeah, this is, I kind of feel The Shining, like structurally, this is very Shining like. And then by the end of the movie, I was like, no, this is a Bergman film, almost straight up. Like if Bergman had been making horror films in 2015 or 2016,
well, some of those slower moments, this is what it would look like. Especially, I was like,
well, and
when it lingers and like,
right.
And it kind of, okay, this film, again, I did like this film. I thought it was pretty good. Completely agree with you. I wasn't necessarily blown away by it. I was like, oh, yeah, it was good.
Because it's interesting, actually, because a lot of people, especially horror fans, are not all about this movie.
You know, I don't think it's necessarily just the horror. It's more the tone. I think I'm more of a popcorn film enthusiast. I mean, truthfully. I mean, I like a little bit of intellectual, and even I like some of the stuff you talked about, the Ingmar Bergman, and I can see the quality and how good it is. That being said, like, yeah, there were times that I was like, I just do kind of like lingering on. I can't necessarily say anything besides that's my, there's nothing I can point to in the film and say, this is bad about the film. Because it's not about the film. It's about me as a viewer. My inclinations as a viewer. I like something maybe a little bit more rock and roll in a way, because you say black metal, but black metal would be, I think, a little bit more.
What I mean by black metal isn't necessarily the tone of the film. I mean, it's not like a big hard rocking, like, you know, beat a minute kind of thing.
Yeah.
What I mean by it is specifically the how explicitly satanic it is in its message. And again, by satanic, I mean more in a philosophical sense than in an actual religious sense.
You don't mean in the Exorcist way. You mean it as in theatrical pissed off atheism. That's what you mean.
Right. I mean in the actual LaVeyan, that's what I meant. And by the look of the movie, the dark trees and the shadows and stuff.
There's an oppressiveness to it.
Right.
I think this film is good. It's absolutely great, actually. And I understand your take on it completely. But again, I couldn't help but be sitting in it and sometimes just kind of feel like, okay, it's meandering.
There's a moment in the middle of the movie when, because it has a really, really kind of punchy beginning. Like, it's like, whoa, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening. And then it kind of lets you experience this family drama. Mm-hmm. And it kind of becomes pretty much pre-colonial sort of melodrama for a lot of the middle of the movie.
That's part of the melodrama, though, too, is that it's just, there is just a family struggle to it. And something that even if you took the religion out, it would still work.
No, yeah,
that's why I can't support any of the interpretations, because I think everything you've said is there. I think it is. But I think that there's so many other takes of the movie, too, that and it's purposefully built in for a reason. And I don't think it's a bad reason. I just think it's good storytelling. But I don't think that there's necessarily anything wrong with that middle part.
I didn't mean that in a bad way.
Yeah, I'm talking about my own bias as a reviewer. I prefer a little bit more rock and roll to my movies.
I think you'll come around to this.
Oh, I think it's a good movie. I think it will grow on me more, even something like Z for Zachariah. Which I end up just thinking about randomly still. That's a movie I thought of when watching this. So I was like, oh yeah, Z for Zachariah is a really ambiguous film that I'm still going like, well, what about this part? Well, what about this part? I do think it has the pieces to make to kind of so we can talk in all this kind of subtextual language. And I love that about it. Absolutely love that about this film. And again, it's not even a criticism of the film. It's a criticism of my own, tastes. It's not even saying bad or good. It's just saying I prefer something a little bit more rock and roll.
Right.
And more in a conventional sense, too. Yeah. It's not Cabin in the Woods.
It's a Cabin in the Woods movie. It's not Cabin in the Woods.
Yes. It's what really a Cabin in the Woods does to us as humans. Right.
I could say this is almost sort of like a sister film to something like Antichrist, although not nearly as hysterical.
And not nearly as provocative. I as a horror fan, I do have some fetishes. I do like horror comedy and I like it when they're big, obnoxious, loud and bloody. That being said, I mean, this more tickled me in my love of art film movies.
I think there's enough stuff there that is genuinely creepy. Mm-hmm. And I think that a certain type of film goer who maybe doesn't see this kind of movie all the time, I don't know, you could probably flip a coin on whether they'll respond to it or they won't, or whether they'll think it's creepy or they won't. I think that it's actually more creepy in its implications than it is in its actual execution in some regards.
Oh, the ideas are definitely more creepy. This isn't a boo scare movie either.
No, there's a few gotcha moments, but very few, and they're very earned. But when I was thinking about it later, and I'm kind of piecing it together, and I'm like, oh, so this could actually mean this, and that's when I was like, oh, that movie is actually pretty fucked up. If you just list out the things that are quote unquote bad things to happen to characters in movies. Mm-hmm. It has a pretty big quota. It's just played out in such a way. It reminds me a lot of Hour of the Wolf. I remember I played that movie in front of friends as supposed to be a double feature with The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
And we never got to The Shining because everyone left after Hour of the Wolf.
That's also not a party movie to me, but.
No, I know. I mean, it was mostly my fault. But I, 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 there was, like a lot of the stuff that I've read, negative stuff about the movie that I've read after seeing it, mm-hmm. not reviews, but just, you know, the hoi polloi on like the IMDb message boards and that type of stuff.
Sure.
Is the exact same stuff I was hearing after I showed Hour of the Wolf to people.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't get it. The plot's all over the place. Like, I don't get why don't they show this if this is supposed to mean this? And then I feel like, you know, I mean, it's kind of a cliche to say they're just not getting it, but they're just not getting it.
No, and I don't think that they will, because I mean, let's say Bergman was alive and made a film in this style, which he very much could, like you said. Yeah. Or do you think that it would be well reviewed within the internet sphere? I mean,
no.
I mean, honestly, I mean, this is going to appeal to a very specific person.
Even though it was open wide. And I think it's important to say that, you know, or it's important to remember mm-hmm. that when The Shining was released, it won 2 Razzie Awards.
Right.
And was not well reviewed and was not even well regarded by fans until about 10 years later, as with most Kubrick films. And I think that this movie is working on that level. I think this is a pretty heady movie, and I think that it needs to be seen more than one. I want to see it again.
I think this
not just because I liked it, but also because I want to be able to really kind of see all the pieces laid out now that I know what it's kind of about.
Right, right, right.
And I also think that given 10, 20, 30 years, this could be seen in the same way that we look at something like The Shining.
I don't think it's as accessible as The Shining, truthfully. I think it is heady in a lot of things you said, and I think it is certainly more heady than The Shining. I think that there are things in The Shining that are very much more just genre-esque that people can tap into. And I would say more because it's not 1630s, you can relate to it a lot easier. So I think it's always going to have a place. I don't think it's going to be as nearly as accessible as some of those films you've mentioned. I think it's going to be more like Bergman-esque.
We should move on.
Yeah, we should.
We've talked about this movie a lot, and I could talk about it for ages because I just think it's terrific. I didn't even talk about how I fucking love the cinematography and all of the candlelit stuff.
We didn't talk about that, but it's very well done. We didn't really talk about performances. We actually got more into a subtext kind of discussion, which I prefer, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, all that other stuff's good. Like I said, there's not a lot to complain about with the movie. I at a technical level.
Let's go ahead and get into our final review then, which is Peter Jackson's Heavenly Creatures, a kind of different style thriller, although surprisingly in some ways not that different.
No, I think this has a lot of has a lot of intelligence as well, but.
Yeah, and it thematically lined up in some weird ways, in ways that I didn't perceive. But go ahead and describe what happens in Heavenly Creatures.
Heavenly Creatures is about two girls in 1950s, I believe.
Yeah.
New Zealand. And basically, they, you know, this new girl moves to his town, and they get into this really intense friendship. And they do just kiddie stuff. They, you know, things that the girl, you know, they really like each other. They really, and then it starts turning and becoming a little different and, it takes a more sinister turn towards the end. Now this film is done by Peter Jackson, and it's very interesting, when it falls in his kind of, in his, like, his oeuvre, his films, you know, because, I mean, this is in between his, you know, his dirty horror films, his, like, almost Troma-esque kind of, but except done a little bit more with a warmer touch. Like Dead Alive, I think, is a very warm movie for how bloody it is. Very warm, affectionate movie. But this comes between those kind of films and, like, his Lord of the Rings films, which is a very different Peter Jackson. And this falls right in the middle and kind of actually makes his career make a little bit more sense. Also, if you think of, like, film that I didn't like, but it's similar-esque as Lovely Bones.
In fact, it's interesting to think of this movie in terms of that one, because I think that Lovely Bones fails in a lot of the ways that Heavenly Creatures weirdly succeeds.
Right. Well, you've got two, basically, what's interesting about this film too, is it's very much in the perspective of the two girls played by Kate Winslet and
Melanie Lynskey. From Togetherness.
Yes.
She's in that now.
Yeah. Except she's a child in this.
They both are, yeah.
Oh, yeah. If you know either of them, it's a little weird. But it's very much from their perspective. And I would say this film even dips in. It kind of goes into their fantasies. And it kind of plays this weird, whimsical tonal thing where it goes between very realistic, like, kind of melodrama and very, like almost fantasy-esque, like, Terry Gilliam-esque things, really. Mm. Have these, like, clay statues that come to life and do things and stuff like that.
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of, like, I could have almost seen Gilliam attached to this project in his, like, imagination trilogy kind of stuff.
I was thinking more like almost like Fisher King in that kind of a blend. I think this, just to kind of, to also stop beating around the bush, I think this is a great film. I really appreciated the warmth of it. It's very interesting seeing, you know, these two very kind of actually charismatic girls, kind of silly, and kind of brings you into their world, and you're kind of taken into their fantasy life.
Their naivety.
Yeah. But then you can see where it takes that gruesome turn towards the end. This film, you could kind of almost, like, if we're doing pairings, because we're talking about pairings today, so it's like with your food, your wine kind of pairing. I would say Heavenly Creatures would be a good pair with, like, something like Rope or, like, The Fisher King, one of those kind of movies, either of those movies.
Yes.
Probably more so Rope. It definitely plays within that kind of thriller atmosphere, but in the warmest way, because... Like Rope, you know that they're bad. It's just about exposing them. Where this is about, like, getting into their headspace, where they were, how they got there. And in a way, you relate to them, but that's almost the creepiest part of this film.
Yeah, there's a weird tone thing going on here, which is tricky, and it's surprising that it works at all, given what he's trying to do, because he introduces the movie knowing they've done something bad. You don't know what it is exactly, but you know the opening shot, they're covered in somebody else's blood, and then it takes a big to How I Met This Girl, and you know,
yeah,
whatever, and then it's actually very light for a lot of it, and pretty funny. Like, Peter Jackson has a good sense of humor, and he came from a world of dark comedy, and there's a lot of this kind of quirky, almost sort of British-ish humor.
Well,
and boarding school kind of society of manners type of humor.
Well, it's actually, it's the storytelling is just done really well, because because like you said, it starts out very vicious. And like, when I first saw this, I was like, whoa, what am I watching? And then it goes into this very light kind of pleasant movie. But within those fantasies is where he kind of just dapples this little bit of violence, and where you're kind of seeing, like, these, you know, how these girls got to this horrible conclusion. And it's very, to me, also because it kind of fits one of my I guess, fetishes about crime and regular people doing violent things and how they get there.
15-year-old lesbians?
Yes.
That's one of your fetishes? Yeah.
That's good. You got me there. I meant more in a fetishistic, like, in a more obsessive way, in a less sexual way. That is an interesting perspective from this film, too. And you are talking about, again, society and religion to some degree. And I kind of think society and religion are kind of one and the same, because you could say a society completely devoid of religion still imposes those kind of things on you.
Right. Well, one sort of justifies the other, and they become intertwined and interlinked. Dogma versus natural human fears,
I mean,
that kind of stuff.
It's not like people didn't do bad things when it was communist Russia. Like, I mean,
no, or any other culture that has a completely different set of values.
But it's interesting to me in this film, because I like how it shows how those societal constraints on specific groups, how they can kind of twist something that's actually pretty warm and not that, you know, and it's not hurting anybody, but, you know, it's not hurting anybody. Except for not the societal constraints, but specifically this kind of this loving
schoolgirl crush stuff. Yeah.
And
I mean, I do think that...
What did you think from about that perspective?
Well, I really like the movie in general.
Especially at the time period it came out. It's very interesting.
Right. But Jackson's doing some interesting, like going back to the tone stuff, he's doing some interesting things because he does, like you said, he's playing with this idea that they're just this cute couple and they're like figuring themselves out and they're realizing, you know, their sexual inclinations and that kind of stuff in a very kind of pure way because it's not like they've learned about it on TV or they have any kind of example in their real life. It's very naturalized.
Mm-hmm.
It just realizes itself naturally between the two and it goes from best friends forever. We're sort of, you know, we'd have to do everything to each other to schoolgirl crush to becoming very, 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 very intense. And as that intensity, that's redundant to say, but intensifies, they begin to enter into their fantasy world, these books they're writing and these dolls they're making out of clay and this other world they've created, literally another world they've created in their minds for when they don't want to be part of the real world. And it's this world they've created together. They start to enter that more and more and more, and the movie starts to enter that more and more and more and less and less and less in the real world. And even though it's kind of played like, you know, Terry Gilliam style Monty Python, like animated silliness, the implication that they are becoming less and less attached to reality starts to see that, yes, there is a sexuality thing here going on and a societal pressure on that, but more so than anything, because even when they like go to like therapists and they're like, yeah, they might have an unhealthy friendship, you might want to separate them. Mm-hmm. The parents don't seem to take it that seriously. It's not like an American Baptist kind of thing where it'd be like, now you're going to go into an ex-gay camp for the next 3 years of your life and we're going to shock your genitals.
Well,
like that's it's kind like, of, well, they treat it more like, they treat it more like, yeah, they might have lice, so just don't let them sleep in the same bed for quite as long.
Well, right, and that's what's kind of interesting about the film, too. In that sense,
Everybody approaches it so naively.
It's a little bit more nuanced, though, too. Some of the things, yeah. Just to comment, just kind of add to what you're saying, also something that I think Peter Jackson does really well here is he never sexualizes them. Like, even though it's them exploring their sexuality, I don't think there's never this overt, like, let's look at 15-year-old girls very pervy. Even though sometimes they're kind of nude or they are doing sex scenes or something like that, you very much understand their perspective.
There's an innocence to everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's...
Even though ultimately the story has incredibly high stakes and it's anything but innocent.
Right.
Which is the movie's playing with juxtapositions the whole time. Mm. And the fact that it's able to juggle all these, like, these extremes and all these different, tones and all of these different kind of, perspectives. And it does so pretty well, is a testament to the filmmaking and to the storytelling and to the acting.
Yeah, no, I think this was a great film. I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And, again, it's really interesting to think about it in his if you're a Peter Jackson fan or you like some of his old stuff and his new stuff, it's an interesting kind of in between. Also, again, I think that to come out in the period it did, to talk about it how it did, and to not like sexualize them, not to do anything like that. Like, I think this is a better film. You can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think that this is a much more interesting and better film when it's kind of about gay characters than a lot of the films that have been coming out that more directly kind of talk about it. I think,
right.
I mean, maybe in a kind of a bad way, because I mean, if you see Rope and other films like that as a microaggression or what, I don't know what fucking word you want to use, but,
a stigmatization or whatever, that, kind of demonization of a specific subculture. It's really interesting thinking about the queer perspective of movies like this and movies like Basic Instinct and B. Ruby Rich, who literally wrote the book on queer cinema. She did a whole chapter on what she calls the lethal lesbian movies, and she name drops this movie in that segment, along with Basic Instinct and the Wachowskis' first movie, Bound.
Probably Thelma and Louise.
And Thelma and Louise, which kind of predated it a little bit. But yeah, that definitely fits into the sort of like micro genre. And one of the things that's interesting about it is most of all of these movies were made by straight men at the time.
Well, again,
and they were not made. They were not made for gay audiences, but lesbians in particular really, really liked these movies. One, because there was just so little representation that you'll take whatever scraps you get. And two, they found them to be very empowering, even because it's sort of them against straight society. These characters against straight society. And yes, they're acting out in illegal ways and they're acting out in kind of vicious ways. And it's not necessarily positive representation, but it's about sort of taking that narrative and flipping it and turning it into your own narrative.
Well, and, it's not,
which is a big part of the queer perspective of cinema anyway.
Well, obviously it's not right what they do in the end, you know, but at the same time, like the film does show them as very innocent, and it kind of shows you how they got to that point and how it forced them. So it's very humanizing.
Yes.
I don't necessarily think that's one perspective of the film. Again, it's a blend. It's done really well. It's a very just, it's kind of an easy film to watch, and it's more creepy when you think about it than the actual film.
Because the movie's actually very funny. I found myself laughing a lot. It's because he plays like these certain characters, like they're these, you know, kind of these sort of bumbling BBC kind of stereotypes, and he does it kind of with a wink and a nod, and there's definitely a lot of irony in the humor, dark irony in the humor.
In some situations, it's there. Those, you know, not all people who do bad things are, you know, maniacal people sitting out in the woods sharpening knives for 20 years.
No, and nobody in this movie, even the ones who do the worst things, nobody in this movie is a bad person. The movie does not ever say, oh, here's your good guys, here's your bad guys. Everybody is, it's almost like this tragic misunderstanding or this tragic misstep in parenting or this tragic a lot of things. And it just kind of spins out of control as a situation without, you know, if anything, it's about communication. And the importance of
The communication, but also
keeping
like
keeping communication open.
Getting kind of if we're talking about that, it's to me, it's more about how the societal bounds on people can sometimes be unhealthy, and like you have to allow people, even if you don't disagree, if you disagree, whatever, you have to allow them to be able to do, to just be humans, and discover things how they're going to discover them. So, no,
Witch.
Yeah, just like the witch. She's got to go out there and find her people. I really dug this film. And I say if you haven't seen it I think most people should check it out. I can't think of a whole lot of people who wouldn't appreciate this at some level.
This is also talked a lot about, I think, the height of Miramax and sort of when they were putting out a lot of interesting mid-budget kind of stuff. And it's good. It's a good movie.
Agreed.
And next week, what are you assigning me?
Next week, I'm assigning you Talladega Nights, Will Ferrell, and I wanted to say Bill O'Reilly, but that's not it. John C. Reilly. There we go. It would have been funny. It'd be funny to see him in a Will Ferrell comedy as well.
I don't know.
For maybe the same reasons.
That guy has almost no sense of humor about anything. Mostly himself.
Well, yeah, but that's what makes him funny. So we're going to be watching Talladega Nights because neither of us have seen it. So we're going to check it out. See if it holds up to the Adam McKay, him winning an award season kind of comedy. I don't know. Something like that.
And by the end of next episode, the Oscars will have happened. So I'm sure we'll talk about that a little.
I didn't plan that. Most of the time, I think when there are connections in the show, we never mean it.
No, it's always an accident. Yeah. Synchronicity. And if anybody has anything to add to our conversations today about The Witch or Heavenly Creatures or Talladega Nights or the Oscars, if you have opinions on how that all went down, we'll read it on air when we record. You can send us your thoughts at our email address at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. Go to Facebook. Find us there at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. We're also on Twitter @jabberpodcast. Follow us. Also, subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio or Zune, Pocket Cast, and the Windows Podcast Network. You can read my work over at my blog, saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, where I post my reviews that I do every week for the Idaho State Journal, as well as some content that I provided the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. You can also check out my friend Brad, who used to do the Quarter Life Crisis podcast, his webzine, medium.com/panel-frame, where I've done a few articles, but more so than anything, just go to check it out because they pump out a lot of content every week, including comics and essays and criticism and short stories. We have some friends out there who also do podcasts, and we recommend that you listen to all of them, including Leland over at his Olympia, Washington-based podcast, dampercast.com, Rod and Denise down here in Southern California, their music request podcast, The Listening Party, and our friend Patrick, who we'll have on the show here shortly, I hope, at Almost Educational and Make Dad Read Comics. Until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one.
Bye.